Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And this is a special listener mail edition, so we better call the robot over here. Added fanfare for the robot. Nice.
Yeah.
Well, we've been neglecting him recently. We've been running the habit of just focusing on the episodes, and we continue to get all this great listener mail in, and we read it. We really appreciate it. We respond where we can during our busy days, but eventually we build up enough. We have to get to it. We have to let the robot out of his lair, and then this is what happens. We devote a whole episode, especially your feedback about names. We received so many emails about nominative determinism, about how the name that we were given, how it affects our ultimate outcome in life and our opportunities in life, and how we see ourselves, how other people see us and treat us. And obviously, everyone out there has a name. Everyone out there has some sort of an opinion on to what extent their name is affecting who they are. So we received a lot of cool content. We cannot go through all of it.
No, at some point, I feel like we had something like six a day just on nominative determinism. So, yeah. Let them fly.
All right. We heard from Polly, who wrote in and mentioned that her name was supposed to be Apollonia, which, of course, is the god of music, poetry, art, oracles, archery, plague, medicine, sun, light, and knowledge. But she says her parents chickened out and named her Pauline instead. But she went back around and reclaimed Apollonia.
Yes.
And so she writes to us as Polly.
Ah, okay. So. And also the Muse of Prince, you forgot, Apollonia.
The Muse of Prince is in Prince the singer?
Yeah.
The
Purple Rain, I believe. Like, there's a character, Apollonia.
Oh.
I could be wrong.
I remember there was a character in the movie Overdrawn in the Memory Bank named Apollonia. But that's my main in for that name. All right. We also heard from our listener, Jasper. Jasper was actually given the birth name Luke. He says he grew up in a very strict Christian dad, and he was getting into the trouble all the time, so he associated that name with getting caught. And Luke, of course, means light and an enlightened one, and has the same root as the name Lucifer. And so he ended up eventually rebelling against his former identity and choosing Jasper as his new identity, which I think this is an important aspect in a lot of people's history with their names. Either you're given one version of your name and you end up sort of shifting it into your own personal identity, or many people just straight up abandon it. Sometimes they're abandoning the simple name for the stranger name, or it seems like just as often it's the opposite of that. They end up taking the strange name and exchanging it for the normal one. It's kind of like the Starbelly Sneetches and the Star Machine, right?
Yeah, I think I took the E off of my name at one point as a tiny youth.
So you're July?
Speck of a youth. Yeah. And then another point, I think I wanted to put some umlauts over the U, but what's the point of that?
Yeah.
It's already Julie.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just shifted around from various boring versions of my boring name. I mean, it's basically just varying levels of masculine and feminine. You have Robert, you have Rob, you have Robbie, you have Bobbin. It seems like a Robin. I was named, people would refer to me as all of those, depending on where they were in my family.
Didn't you post something once that it was like the lifespan of the name Robert? Like, as a young kid, the boy is called Robbie?
Yeah, I can't take credit for creating it, but someone on the internet created this kind of timeline.
Yeah.
Where it's like the cycle of life. In the morning and the dawn of your years, I guess you're Robbie.
Robbie.
And
you reach manhood
and Robert.
And then in the sunset years, you're Bob.
Yeah. All right. Now, here's an interesting bit of feedback on the same topic. And this comes to us from Paige. Paige writes in and says, I'm surprised you didn't discuss or at least mention changing one's name in adulthood or for that matter, in infancy. A friend of mine had to rename her child because no one could pronounce the original name. I was born with a name which stereotypically did not match my gender. There were several boys all through primary school with the same name, and perhaps that influenced my departure from the feminine. Apparently, at as young as 5 or 6, I was introducing myself by different names, and at 15 started going by a nickname completely disconnected from my birth name. Nicknames changed, and eventually when I was 18, I worked out what would be a good new name for myself, then went down to the office of births, deaths, and marriages and changed it. I've been Paige ever since, and just hearing my birth name makes me uncomfortable. Did I perhaps change my destiny by changing my name? How does hating one's name and refusing to use it whenever possible affect things? How are babies or children affected when their name is changed? And how do children who cannot pronounce their names fare? My daughter has a speech impediment and cannot pronounce her shortened name, Miwi versus Mealy, let alone her first long name. Thanks for the podcast. I've been listening for over a year now, and when I found you, I devoured them all as quickly as I could. Paige, I read this entire email because here on the episode because I think she did raise a lot of cool points.
Yeah.
She's going to be, you know, chewing over the issues involved in naming and reclaiming a name or abandoning a name.
I kind of feel like altering your name is a sort of rite of passage anyway, and it does seem to happen in those teenage years when you're trying to figure out what your personality is, who mm-hmm. you want to be in the world.
Yeah, indeed. And as far as the speech issue goes, my son has is catching up on his speech mm-hmm. because he had cleft lip, cleft palate. And his name is Sebastian, but we just call him Bastion in the home because he can say that easier. And I also think toddlers seem to really go for more of the one or two syllables anyway. Like that third syllable, that's just something to trip over. So you might as well cut it down. But we also made sure that we named the new cat a name that he could say easily, because we're like, we want him to be able to say the cat's name. We're not going to give it some crazy name like Zartanian or something. So we
yeah.
called the new cat Mochi, and that he can say.
Yeah, one of my daughter's earliest little snuggly toys was named Esmeralda,
uh-huh.
and people would get so annoyed with us. They'd be like, she can't pronounce Esmeralda.
What would she call it?
She never really cottoned to it, so we never had to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
But shoot high. That's what I'm saying.
Because they seem to come up with strength. Like if they can't or don't want to say all the syllables in something,
mm-hmm.
they're really weird about how they pick and choose. For instance, my son, for whatever reason, is still calling water Ewa. Like why? Like clearly you can say wa, and you could hit it more on the head, I think, but instead he's calling it Ewa to the point where I have to stop myself from thinking of it as Ewa. Because it does sound, I'll give him
you
that,
did,
it sounds good.
You did ask me to give you your glass of Ewa the other day,
oh,
and I was like, what?
There you go. All right, here's another bit of listener mail. This comes to us from Nathan in Australia. Nathan says, my grandfather's name was Victor. He was a champion rugby league player, lawn bowler, and golfer. So there's another example of a name that may or may not have pushed the individual onto victory.
Right, to
Victor.
Be the victor.
Yeah. And on a similar note, here's one from Victoria, also in Australia. We have a lot of listeners in Australia. She writes in and says, I thought you might be interested in a story about my name. As you can see from my email, it's Victoria Strike. But here's more to it, because you see, I'm adopted. 5 years ago, I found my biological family, and their surname is Force. So, technically, I'm Victoria Strike Force. My boyfriend, on the other hand, has been terribly unlucky. His name is Ben. Ben Laden. Or Bin Laden.
Oh, like Bin
Laden, perhaps. Either way, close enough to conceivably cause some problems. I want to thank you for the podcast. It rocks and makes my daily train ride to work a joy.
Thank you, Victoria.
We had Gillian write into us and give us some very cool feedback on the episode and on some other topics as well. But pointed out that they worked in a hospital where there was a doctor, the last name D-O-C-K-T-O-R. So,
and people refer to the doctor as doctor.
Doctor, yes. And here's an interesting question, finally. This is brought up to us by our listener, Zarek. Zarek, of course, has a very cool first name, if I may say so, a very creative first name. So he mentioned that he, even though his parents were very fond of the name and said that they made it up for him, especially, he felt limited by it. He felt like it wasn't his name. It felt alien to him. Anyway, he asked, do you think you, quote, normals, unquote, could explain to a person with a weird, foreign, meaningless name what it feels like to have a common name? Does it just feel like nothing? Because that's more or less how I feel about my name most of the time. And that's an interesting question. Because like I say, I've always felt like my name is boring. And I've always felt like my normal name is just, it's almost like a number I'm given. Like I don't feel a particular attachment or identity to it.
Yeah.
I am just sort of, I am who I am in spite of having the name Robert Lamb.
Well, I mean, the thing is that when you have a normal name and you're introducing yourself, people often misremember it as another normal name, like Shirley or Judy, Julie, you know. And so, Zarek, I would say that people probably pay a little bit more attention to your name, maybe even more attention to you as a person, because they don't automatically have these sort of common associations with your name. I think it's kind of awesome. Although I understand, like, if you don't, maybe there's a sense of otherness with that name that you might feel more than the average Joe.
Yeah.
Haha.
Yeah, it does seem like a situation where you can't really win. You give a kid a weird name, they're going to want a normal one. You give a kid a normal name, they're going to want a weird one.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the solution is you have to give them both, and then they can sort of pick and choose which one they want to go with.
Well, isn't there already that idea that this generation will need to change their name by age 18 anyway because of security issues and oversharing on the internet?
That is just true. So I wonder to what extent the normal, abnormal name shift will feature into that. Do you tend to have a crazier name during this rebellious wild stage, or is that when you have a normal name and you're rebelling against it?
And if you're going to live to be 500 years old, as Aubrey de Grey, the biogerontologist, says, maybe just keep changing your name like every century, right?
Yeah, just keep reinventing yourself because you're going to forget most of everything that's happened to you anyway, right?
Yeah. All right, we got a couple of emails about proprioception, this idea of figuring out where your body is in space and time. And here is one from Brenna. She says, I enjoyed your recent podcast. I am a therapist who works with infants and toddlers with special needs ages 0 to 5. Many of my kids have challenges with proprioception, and children, delays in proprioception often present as difficulty interacting with objects in themselves. For example, the children's song Wheels on the Bus encourages children to rotate their arms in a circular pattern around each other. Robert and I are doing this right now.
Oh, yeah. This is a popular song at home.
It is. It's a good song. Children need motor planning and proprioception to carry out this action. However, because they don't yet understand where their body is in space and time in relation to itself, they often have greater difficulty with this complex action. And she goes on to say that if they have delays in proprioception, it's not uncommon that their vestibular sense is affected as well. And when that's affected, it can be really difficult to manage proprioceptive needs. So you're talking about balance and coordination. And she says that in adults, you can kind of adapt. But in kids, it's really hard. I'm paraphrasing, by the way. She says because they never learned the skill to begin with. And so she says if there are any listeners with kids who have difficulty with proprioception or vestibular development, she wanted to share a couple of at-home activities that parents can do with their kids. She says that activities that involve heavy pushing and pulling, which in turn provide greater sensory feedback. You can fill a wagon with toys to pull, pushing a toy grocery cart, or rolling weighted balls. She said that's a great start, but no more than 10% of their body weight for the pushing and pulling. You can buy a pop-up tunnel or a tent to give them practice traveling through different spaces. Again, we take all of this for granted, right?
Mm-hmm.
She said a good old-fashioned pillow fort is great, too. And songs like Head, Shoulders, Knees, and Toes, if you know that one, if you're happy and you know it, Ladybug, these are all good for coordination with body parts. And finally, she says that you could kind of create a swing with a blanket or a towel. She says she uses a toy parachute, and she twists the ends together with the child inside. She gently lifts the child a couple inches off the floor and lets them swing from side to side. And that the kids love this, and they pop their head out to see what's going on. Again, things that we take for granted, this idea that you're moving through space and time. And I've always wondered about this because I've noticed that as my daughter develops, she's 5 years old now, when she seems to be going through a growth spurt, she seems to be falling a lot more. And I wonder if it's because the borders of your body are rapidly changing.
Huh.
And you're not as familiar with how your body's moving through space and time.
It's like having iTunes or Adobe on your machine. It constantly needs the updates. And
yeah.
You can't keep up with the number of updates that are required to properly orient yourself in time and space, perhaps.
Yeah, and I also remember, too, that when I was pregnant, particularly in the third trimester, I really did not know where I was. I mean, like, I would go through, I would bump into things all the time because I didn't really have a sense of the borders of my body, and I wonder if any other women experience that. So proprioception continues to be this really fascinating topic.
Yeah, we received another email on the topic from Michael. Michael wrote in with an email titled Proprioception Glitches. He says, several years ago, I had a table saw accident that resulted in my left index finger spending a couple of months wrapped in bandages. When the bandages came out, my doctor told me to touch as many different textures as possible and to look at my finger as I did it so that my brain would know how to interpret the signals it was receiving. The damage to my finger followed by a long swaddling essentially rebooted my brain's relationship with my finger, and I had to retrain it. During this reboot process, I developed a habit of rubbing my index finger and thumb together.
Huh.
Several years later, I injured my thumb and was surprised to find that my index finger was also feeling the pain of the injury. Apparently, a few wires end up getting crossed thanks to my little nervous tic.
Huh, okay. Here's another one about proprioception. This is from Jay in Tillsonburg, Ontario, Canada. And he says that when I was younger, I raced a bit of motocross and rode for fun since I was 8 years old. On a few rare occasions when racing as hard as I could, I would get into an almost meditative mind state where I would swear the bike felt like a part of me. I could almost feel the ground under my front tire as if an extension of my arms and the feel of the traction left in the soil through the soles of my feet. While either in the air or on the throttle, where I ended and the bike began, felt blurred. This was also when I felt the fastest and most confident on the bike. Now, I was no superstar racer, so I wonder whether the pros or other bikers have had the sensation. Thanks again, Jay. Our boss, or sort of not boss anymore, Connell, actually uses a motorcycle, and he'd mentioned before, he uses that as his main form of transportation, that when he's in traffic and he's on the highway, that he gets into this meditative state with the bike because it's such a trepidatious ride that he really has to focus all of his energy into what he's doing on that bike. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. That sort of lines up with what Jay is saying.
Interesting. All right. We also recently did a rerun of our episode on the science of beards, which is a popular episode. And to no one's surprise, it was popular again the second time. So we received this one from Renee. Renee writes in, I'm sending this on account of the Science of Beards episode, which I listened to today while running. The topic of facial hair has always interested me. Why certain people prefer certain styles, different reasons why people have it, etc. I enjoyed your episode and thought you would like to hear some things I know. When you talked about Abraham Lincoln liking to wrestle and having a beard, I was surprised you did not mention the story of why he grew his beard. You might already know it, but here is some of the letter written to Lincoln while he was running for office.
Going to summon my Laura Ingalls Wilder here.
Okay.
Dear sir, my father has just come home from the fair and brought home your picture and Mr. Hamlin's. I am a little girl, only 11 years old, but want you to be President of the United States very much, so I hope you won't think me very bold to write to such a great man as you are. I have got 4 brothers, and part of them will vote for you anyway, and if you let your whiskers grow, I will try and get the rest of them to vote for you. You would look a great deal better, for your face is so thin. All the ladies like whiskers, and they would tease their husbands to vote for you, and then you would be president. My father is going to vote for you, and if I was a man, I would vote for you, too. But I will try to get everyone to vote for you that I can.
Well, there you go, from the mouths of babes, right?
Talking about whiskers, how adorable.
Making his face look thicker and more capable of taking a punch.
I think she was like the first focus group.
Yeah, accidentally, I think she was. All right, here's another one about beards. This is from Martin. Howdy from Texas, y'all. I just heard your podcast on beards. As a bearded fellow, I thought I'd share some of my experience with the general public. I have had quite the mixed reaction to my beard, but the one thing that really struck me was that the larger portion of the younger generation has a positive reaction to my beard and is usually impressed, but the older, 30s and up, seem to have a more negative reaction. One 70-ish fellow even went so far as to tell me that society would fix me, and that if I didn't shave that bleep off, I'd wind up in a loony bin. The older people get, the more negative their statements. Besides that, my girlfriend likes my beard, and most of my friends are in agreement that I look better with it than without it. That might be because I have a hatchet face.
Oh, we doubt that.
The podcast was the first podcast that made me go to y'all's website, and speaking of faces, I was surprised at how y'all looked. Y'all should do a podcast about voices and faces and how we associate them. I thoroughly enjoy the show. Keep up the good work. Martin.
All right. Thanks, Martin. Yeah, we hear from listeners from time to time. They're like, oh, my God, I saw photos of you guys, and this is not at all what I imagined, and I'm deeply upset because I imagined something else for you.
Well, you know, he mentioned, you know, Martin here is from Texas, and I instantly thought to NPR. There's one NPR reporter from Texas that's often featured. You've probably heard him.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a real real Texan voice, but got a soothing voice. Almost like there's a little bit of Wilford Brimley in there and a little bit of Mari Stouffer from the old, wildlife show. You know, mm-hmm. Very soothing. And so I form in my mind this kind of picture of this bearded Wilford Brimley-esque guy. Maybe a little bit of that character from Parks and Rec with the big, mustache.
Okay.
You know, some of that going on. And then I look him up online and he's just a guy. Like, it does not look like my mental
image. Oh, I thought you were going to say, like, he had a faux hawk.
No.
He had tats.
He doesn't. You know, he's not on the other end of the spectrum, but he's very much at the middle portion of the spectrum where I just would not pick him out of a lineup as that voice any day of the week.
I know. It is interesting psychologically what we do when we make up these ideas of what people should look like. And I do that a lot in fiction, you know, so I can see how people, when they're listening to us, might be a little bit like, what? That's not you.
Yeah. Like I think I said before, nothing irks me more than being many pages into a book, maybe even halfway through, and then the narrator decides to tell me somebody has a mustache. No. Because if they have a mustache, tell me, like, the first sentence.
All right. We have an email from Will, and he is talking about our episode, Heartbeat in the Brain. He says, hey, guys, first time writing in, long time listener. While listening to Heartbeat in the Brain, Hole in the Skull, podcast on my way into work this morning, I found it very interesting, as I do most of the topics. As I was listening, I couldn't help but think about a different kind of hole in the skull for quote-unquote medical purposes, a lobotomy. I first heard of a lobotomy procedure while at college. I went to college down the road from Weston, West Virginia at West Virginia Wesleyan College, which is home to the second largest handstone building in the world, now known as Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum. When it was first built, though, it was known as Weston State Hospital. As the new name implies, the Weston State Hospital was a mental hospital and operated from 1864 to 1994 and has a very dark history over the 130 years of it being open. I believe that either the history of Weston State Hospital or lobotomies would be an awesome follow-up after the Trepanation podcast. Always listening, Will. Thanks, Will. And that just reminded me that in one of the World Science Festival panels that had to do with genetics, eugenics was brought up. Because eugenics sort of, as they discussed it, proliferated during a time period in which a lot of people were being put in mental institutions, and they should not have been put into mental institutions, a number of these people. They might have been drug or alcohol addicts, or they may have just had anxiety problems. In society's idea here in the late 1800s was just lock them up. At the same time, you've got eugenics happening, and they're saying, maybe we could root out these sort of unsavory characters. And along those lines, people began to be sterilized.
Oh, yes.
In these institutions. Well, we also have a number of other things happening, like lobotomies. And so I agree. I think this is a really ripe area for exploration.
So it's not quite on the same level as the procedure that came up in our digestion series about the individual who was treating chronic constipation, by removing the large intestines and just rerouting it so you had direct shoot.
Right.
Yeah.
For a second, I thought you were talking about that moment in Mary Rich's Gulp in which they were talking about, which president is it? He had got shot in the liver,
and so
he couldn't be...
Is that Taft?
I think so. He had to be fed through the anus.
Yeah, the rectal feeding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't really have anything to take
I was
us
not
out
talking
of
about rectal feeding, but thank you for bringing it up.
That's why I just had that moment where I was like, I don't know how to get out of this, Robert, help.
Well, let's get out of it by grabbing another listener mail from the robot here. This one comes to us from Yule. Yule writes to us and says, one of my favorite facts about the moon, which we recently did an episode on, is that it moves away from the Earth at a rate of about 1.5 inches per year. Over an average person's lifetime, 80 years or so, the moon would have moved around 10 feet away from the Earth. There's something comforting and strangely intimate about being able to visualize something that's happening on a celestial scale and relate it to one's time on this planet. Well, certainly, we can relate our time on this planet constantly to celestial movements, which is kind of beautiful in a way.
Yeah, and I thought that was a beautiful email, and kind of in the sort of like Neil deGrasse Cosmos column.
Yeah.
Of looking at the universe in a very big and poetic way. So thank you, Yule. We have an email from Allison on super stimuli, and she attached a picture of Conan the Barbarian, by the way.
Ah, yes. Arnold Schwarzenegger. Great film.
Actually, I think this one is a different a different Conan the Barbarian.
Oh, but is this the one played by the guy from Game of Thrones then? Or the TV show maybe even?
I think so. Yeah. He's got giant pecs.
Well,
I'll just put it that way.
That could be any Conan.
Okay. She says, when I think of super stimuli, my mind goes straight to those big, tall, and muscular guys in action movies who don't really exist outside of bodybuilding and pro wrestling. It's such an unreal and unrealistic body type, but there's something so compelling about the image. I'm sure this is my version of the super feminized women in pornography. I can't imagine actually having a dude like that over for a potluck. I don't think he'd fit in the chairs at my table. So why do I go all gooey for them in movies? It's pure super stimuli. Great episode. I love your podcast, and I hope that you do them for a very long time. Thank you, Allison. And that just reminded me, too, of Joe Mangiello. I believe that's his name. He was in True Blood. He played the giant wolf dude.
Oh, yeah, the bearded guy, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like, that is super normal stimuli. So I think it's really interesting to look at it from the male perspective. We always think about the male gaze thinking about females in porn.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
No, he's a handsome man. I'll give it to him. I mean, I admit that he's a handsome man. That's what I'm trying to say.
But to her point, you know, how practical is that when you want to have someone over for a potluck? You can't have someone crushing your chairs.
Yeah, and then you don't want them to come over too, and all they eat are, you know, they have some sort of diet where they have to eat two whole chicken breasts and then some sort of protein shake every meal because their whole life is about building and maintaining this body. That's what I always remind myself if I'm watching a movie and someone is particularly ripped. I remind myself, well, what does that person have to do in life but remain ridiculously ripped? That's kind of their job.
Eat 20 roasted chickens.
Yeah. And actually, I find that it tends to get in the way of a film narrative if the actor is unrealistically in shape.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't watched this show yet, but my wife watched this, the Mr. Selfridge show,
mm-hmm.
which is a PBS show about Selfridge, the American who went to Britain and revolutionized the shopping mall experience over there. But Jeremy Piven plays the character, and there's a scene where, you know, this dude, early 20th century, has his shirt off, and he's like super ripped
mm-hmm.
in a way that you just wouldn't. And you just wouldn't expect that kind of body on someone in that position in that time frame.
No, that was very unusual, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's like when you see super white teeth on an actor in a period piece. Like, you know, it's like super white straight teeth. Like, what are you doing? That doesn't look. You're just by smiling. You're taking me out of the historical immersion of the picture.
I know, but there's that whole willing suspension of disbelief.
Yeah,
you got to meet them halfway, Robert.
I'll meet them halfway on the fact that all Romans speak with a British accent, but all Romans shouldn't have teeth that look that perfect.
Fair enough. All right, we've got one more super normal stimuli email from Mike, who says, while listening to the episode, I couldn't help but think about decisions I make every day to either indulge or deny an instinct. And we're talking about here the supernormal stimuli is that sort of thing where, like, you need a little bit of sugar, right? You need a little bit of energy, but you don't need a slice of cheesecake. He says, I would be interested in learning how the decision to deny an instinct works to result in a dose of dopamine. Let's say I decline a piece of cheesecake and instead eat a stalk of celery. Do I feel great because I use my imagination to calculate a supernormal positive outcome? Do people who make virtuous choices actually do so in order to indulge their dopamine habit? I understand where you're going here. Because we talked about this in the last episode when we were talking about the future of addiction, is that if you want to replace a bad habit, you need to do it with another habit because the neural pathway has been established. So if you want to avoid drinking glasses of wine, go and exercise because you're going to get a high from that. But the celery stick, eh.
Hmm. What if you did ants on a log instead?
Get a little peanut butter in there.
Yeah, some raisins.
Well, I guess it brings up the power of psychology. Like, to what degree can you trick yourself into making it a reward?
Yeah. I don't know. The celery, I can't help but think of the recent skit on Portlandia where Steve Buscemi is on there trying to rebrand celery and make it exciting and sexy again. And all they just keep coming back around to ants on a log is the only, like, real option to make celery exciting. Because other than that and soup preparation, you know, what do you do with celery?
I would agree. You got to tart that up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Into a supernormal stimuli.
All right, so there you have it. We've cleared out the listener mail a bit. Again, we don't have time to read or respond to everything that you guys and gals send us, but we greatly appreciate it. Your feedback helps us know what's working, what's maybe not working, or, you know, what topics we need to revisit, what topics we need to explore for the first time. We receive lots of cool ideas, and we would love to continue to get those. So, hey, you want to find us? You want to reach out to us? You can find us at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is our main site, our mothership, our homepage. You will find all of our podcast episodes, our videos, blog posts, links out to our various social media accounts, including Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Also links to our YouTube account, which is Mind Stuff Show. Be sure to go to that page if you want to subscribe and check out all of our cool new video projects. We're constantly thinking up new ways to engage YouTube viewers in science and in our Stuff to Blow Your Mind topics.
Indeed. And make sure to drop us a line if you have more thoughts. We want to hear them, and you can do that at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.